From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The head of police in Haiti says two suspects in yesterday's assassination of President Jovenel Moïse are under arrest, and four others were killed in a standoff. The country remains on edge. NPR's Jason Beaubien joins us now. And Jason, what more do we know about these people who Haitian police say are suspects in this assassination?
So we don't know much. We just know that they're being described as foreigners. They've been described by multiple government officials as foreigners. And that's all we know at the moment. There has been some video footage that has come out of the actual attack itself. And you can hear some people yelling in what very much sounds like American English. But at the moment, this is still the early days of this investigation, and we still do not know exactly who the people are who carried out this assassination.
We do know that President Moïse had been ruling by decree. There was a dispute about when his term ended, and there was supposed to be a new prime minister sworn in this week. So who is in charge right now?
So the acting prime minister, Claude Joseph, who was supposed to be replaced this week, as you mentioned, has pretty much stepped in and placed himself in charge. It is not clear exactly what the line of succession should be here. But at this point in time, the former acting prime minister, Joseph, has stepped in and pretty much is filling that vacuum. Also, you had the head of the Supreme Court. He died of COVID, supposedly, last month. He may have been in line. And there was even questions about whether or not President Moïse was legitimately still in power. So this leaves a huge vacuum in Haiti in terms of who is really in charge right now.
What is life like in the capital today?
So I've been talking with some people there. Yesterday, it sounded like things were very much under lockdown. People were not out in the streets. There was a lot of fear. People were sitting back, listening to their radios, trying to gain information. I've talked to people. It sounds like things are getting back to normal a bit more today. You know, people in Haiti, a lot of them live hand to mouth, need to work every day. So people are getting back out on the streets. People are saying that some markets are reopening. But Haiti has been in a very rough state this year. There's been massive protests against President Moïse over his legitimacy and power. And those street protests, some of them turned violent. There's been definitely a ratcheting up of the actual violence from gangs. It's much worse than it had been at different times. It tends to go in waves, but it's been really bad lately with a lot of kidnappings, a lot of indiscriminate killing on the street. And then in addition, the COVID situation is quite bad there. You're seeing a spike like you haven't seen ever in the pandemic. And that's coming at a time when Haiti is one of the five countries in the world that hasn't even started a mass vaccination campaign. So there's a lot of problems on Haiti's plate right now, and this certainly makes things much, much worse.
NPR's Jason Beaubien, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Our next guest argues you can't talk about the troubled history of Haiti without also acknowledging governments on both sides of the Atlantic have had a hand in that history. Rich Benjamin is a Cullman Fellow at the New York Public Library, researching a book about his grandfather, Daniel Fignolet, who was president of Haiti in 1957 when he was ousted in a coup. Rich, welcome back to Here and Now.
Great to be here, Callum.
Let's start with that family history. Tell us more about your grandfather.
My grandfather was a labor leader in Haiti in the 1940s and 1950s. And at the height of his work, he was in charge of 29 unions, sugar workers, factory workers, barbers, working-class blue-collar Haitians. And ultimately, in 1957, he became president of the country. He was an avowed socialist, not a communist, and he was ousted in a coup 19 days into his presidency. And this has always been a family secret that we didn't talk about so much, a kind of trauma. And in 2010, after the devastating earthquake in Haiti, I decided to research this. And I found myself, Callum, in the U.S. National Archives. And I did not expect to hit a gold mine. And what I found was about 250 pages of documents of U.S. operatives in Port-au-Prince spying on my grandfather. And at the time, these documents were secret and they were classified.
And what have you been able to learn then? I mean, have you been able to piece together a bit more about why he was ousted? I mean, was it because he was left-leaning during the Cold War and the U.S. wanted to shore up its control of its sphere of influence in the Caribbean?
That's very much what I think. And looking on this side of the equation, we can document how corporate executives, especially sugar executives, had called the White House the day after my grandfather's inauguration and told Eisenhower that this man is not acceptable, he's not friendly enough to U.S. business interests, and we could chart the national security meetings after his inauguration where Haiti was on the top of the discussion list.
His successor, of course, was François Duvalier. Do you think that that was a turning point for Haiti, Rich?
I do. And the reason I think that is because Papa Doc Duvalier's regime went on to become one of the worst dictatorships by the number of people who died and who were imprisoned in the history of the U.S. Western Hemisphere. So in many ways, when I visit Haiti, when I think about Haiti, when I research Haiti, the country has kind of never recovered from that. And it's kind of never recovered from all these interventions that have been happening by foreign governments to kind of install Haitian rulers who are best suited to U.S. interests and not necessarily to Haitian interests.
And this is really just in the mid-20th century. There's a longer history than that, of course. If we pull back a bit, we have to talk about how Haiti has for a long time been known as a country under the influence of larger powers. I mean, it was a French colony in the 1800s. It was the first independent nation of Latin America and the Caribbean, the first to abolish slavery. But then the 20th century began with American occupation. So refresh us on that history, Rich. How did that come about?
The U.S. occupied Haiti, and many of us forget that to this day. As the World War I heated up, Haiti was close to America, and President Woodrow Wilson invaded Haiti under the pretext of wanting to deny Germany a staging ground to invade the U.S. But really, U.S. corporate interests had called Wilson after Haiti's president was assassinated and advised him to invade. And so it was a tight tapestry of bankers and railroad magnates and other industrial barons who advised Wilson to invade Haiti. And so the U.S. occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934. And American investors were able to muscle in and acquire some of the nation's best assets, railroads, sugar mills, and thousands of acres of fertile lands. So that's what occupation means, is like who controls the means of production of a country. My grandfather was 2 years old when the U.S. began to occupy Haiti. And, you know, we're fine. We ended up doing fine. But the country is still, I think, dealing with these aspects of a not-so-ancient history.
Well, just to drive home how harsh those conditions were, I mean, the American military used tactics that, if not actual slavery, Rich, were pretty darn close, right? I mean, what's the legacy of that for Haitians today?
Well, for example, they instituted a system of what they called corvée. So they could tell a Haitian, here is a ludicrously high tax. And if you can't pay this tax, we have the right to quote-unquote enlist you and grab you to help build the country. And so they literally roped up Haitians. The military leader in charge of occupation on the ground in Haiti was a guy called W.T. Waller, and he himself was the grandson of Virginia slaveholders.
Just bringing it back to today's news now, Rich. I mean, it's worth remembering that in the months before he was assassinated, the Haitian president, Jovenel Moïse, faced protests against his effort to rewrite the country's constitution. He wanted his office to come with immunity for any actions taken as president. And critics said he was turning Haiti toward an authoritarian state. So his assassination isn't likely to just end this debate about government power and structure. What comes next, do you think?
I think what comes next is people should listen to civil leaders who are on the ground in Haiti who know what's best. If people listen to the people who are doing the hard work of democracy in Haiti, on the ground, throughout the country, as opposed to imposing and kind of finagling foreign rulers who they think will suit short-term interests and look to Haiti's long-term future, I think that might be a wise way to move forward, as opposed to kind of speculating, you know, what would help Washington or what would help other foreign powers better.
Rich Benjamin is a Coleman Fellow at the New York Public Library and the author of the forthcoming book, Talk to Me, a family memoir, in part about his grandfather, Daniel Fignolet, an ousted former Haitian president. Rich, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
For over 70 years, Bobby Rush has been singing the blues. He's written over 400 songs, won 13 Blues Music Awards, and 2 Grammys, the first when he was 83 years old, for his album Porcupine Meat.
I know it ain't right. Oh, it just ain't fair. I want to leave, but I can't go nowhere. It's like porcupine meat. Too bad to eat, too lean to go away. It's like porcupine meat. Too fat to eat, too lean to go away.
Now, Bobby Rush has written a memoir. It's called I Ain't Studdin' Ya, and yeah, that is the name of one of his many songs. The book is filled with stories about his life and his career, reaching all the way back into the Jim Crow era. You're going to hear some offensive language that we'll have to cover up. Recently, Bobby Rush joined me to talk about the book, and I asked him to start with one of his earliest stories, how he taught himself to play the guitar by nailing a wire to the house where he grew up.
We had baling wire come off a hay, you know, you bale. I'm a country boy, but it was too thick. So what I did, my mother had this broom, and on top of the broom, there's a smaller wire around the broom, looked like a guitar string. So I wanted this wire. And I didn't have any way of getting me a wire until the broom wore out. So I went down to the cow pen, and I stuck it in the water and got it wet. And I said, cow, cow, come here. And they ate the broom. And I went back and told my mother, I said, listen, Mother. I said, this broom is wore out. He said, oh, yeah, boy, you can have that broom. And I put it up against the wall, and I put me a brick at the top and a ball at the bottom. So that was the blues, man. That was the blues, man. That's where I started from.
Well, look, you made your career in small and large venues between Chicago, where you lived for quite a while, and the Mississippi Delta. This would become known as the Chitlin Circuit, and in fact, Rolling Stone called you the king.
Yeah, let me talk about that for a minute. See, I came out of a mold where I didn't have enough money to go to Chicago, where I wanted to leave the Southern state because the racial thing and the black and white issue was color this and color that, black this and black that. And I wanted to go to Chicago so bad, but I didn't have enough money to get my ticket all the way to Chicago. But I had enough money to get to Memphis, Tennessee, where B.B. King and Rufus Thomas was playing on Beale Street. And I played on Beale Street to make me enough money, making $2 or $3 a day, to go to East St. Louis, where Albert King and Chuck Berry was. And I made enough money there to go to Little Walton, Muddy Water, and Howlin' Wolf was already in Chicago. I went where that was. So now I'm the king of the Chitlin Circuit. I'm not ashamed of it. I'm who I am and what I am, and I love what I'm doing, and I display my soul into what I do.
You talk a lot in the book about the fact that even though you've had this really long career and you toured a lot and audiences loved you, it took you a pretty long time before you had a hit song. And so let's listen to it. It's called Chicken Heads.
Daddy told me on his dying day, give up your heart, but don't you lose your head. You come along, girl, what did I do? I lost my heart and my head went too.
That is some 1970s funk right there, isn't it?
That's funky stuff, though, man. That's funky stuff. But you got to understand, the record got number one in 1971 and 1972, but the record was cut in 1968. It took me that long to get it on the scene.
Why?
Because I didn't have the contact. I didn't have the know-how. It takes money to make these things run, and it takes a lot of politics. It wasn't who you know, it's who know you.
You did know some people, though, Bobby Rush. You were close with legends like Muddy Waters, B.B. King. I'll talk about those relationships. Were they mentors to you?
What Muddy Waters and guy was talking to me about at that time, how many women they had, how many reefers they could smoke, how long they could stay out, how many girls they had. All that sound good, but it wasn't done anything for my career.
They weren't teaching you about the business.
They weren't teaching me about the business side of it. I did learn a lot from their mistakes. I watched over them and saw some things they were done wrong. And I made the same mistake they made, a lot of them. But I don't want to go down that road. Even when I wrote this, writing this book, I didn't write the book because I want to be known. I want to be popular. I want to write the book because I want people to know if I can make it, you can too.
Well, you do incorporate your life and your life story into your music. The song Talk to Your Daughter refers to a conversation you had with your ex-wife's mother. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
I went down to Arkansas. See, I had a talk with my mother-in-law. I said, Mama, Mama, talk to your daughter. Because she ain't loving me like she oughta. Mama, talk to your daughter.
You did have some major challenges in your life. You nearly died in a gas explosion. You nearly died in a bus crash. You spent time in prison on a drug charge. Three of your children died from complications of sickle cell. I just wonder how you emerged from all of that in one piece.
That was hard for me. That's hard for me to keep going. But every valley that I had, something or somebody come along, lift me out of my valleys. When my three sister-in-laws passed, then my first daughter passed, then my second daughter passed, my wife passed, and my son passed. That was all of my family. I was wiped out. Then I picked my pieces up and licked my wounds, and I went on to do business as a blues singer and just keep singing and doing what I was doing because God was at his work. I want to be obedient to what he sent me to do. Then I got married again and had one child. And this baby boy now is the chief of police in Jackson, Mississippi.
Okay, so listen, you kind of hustled and made it through your entire career, entire life.
You even owned a hot dog stand
and a barbecue joint to make money on the side. You were doing that when other people were cutting records.
Yeah, people was cutting records, but I didn't have the opportunity to cut records like the other people did because I wouldn't be the kind of guy they wanted me to be because the white guys who own the record shops, the record stores, and record company, they wanted you to cut certain kind of music and do certain kind of thing. I didn't want to be that N-word. I didn't want to be the one. You know, if I'm going to be the N-word, I'm going to be it for myself. I'm not going to kiss their butt on their term. Now, I didn't say I wasn't going to kiss no butt, but it's going to be on my term. And I didn't get the contract with all, because I remember when I went to Chess to get a contract, and I didn't get the contract because I could read and write. I remember reading a pamphlet off of one of the guys' desk, and he asked his brother, where did he get that information from? Talking about Bobby Rush. And I said, off his desk. And he throwed it to me. He said, read that to me. What did it say, boy? And I read it to him. He turned and told his brother, said, we can't use that because he can read. And I didn't get the job.
Do you experience a lot of that in the industry? Racism like that?
Yeah, and I incorporate that in my show, the things that I do, and I'm independent. I haven't been always popular because I kind of went against the grain, what to do and what not to do. But one thing for sure, I want to be free. If I never make any money in my life, you looking at and listen to one free man. I'm free because I did it my way.
Well, the fact that you won a Grammy at 83 years old is a signal to all of us that we just got to keep going, right? Keep hanging on. That's what you have done. Let's hear one more song here. This is Time to Hit the Road Again.
You know the time have come for me to hit the road again.
have come, and it's time for me to hit the road again.
Before COVID hit, you were doing 200 shows a year, Bobby Rush. Are you feeling okay? You slowing down?
I'm feeling good now, man. Before the COVID hit, I was doing 200 shows a year for the last 55, close to 60 years. And that's a lot of shows to do, but it kept me up on my toes because I had to work a lot of shows to get the kind of money that the big boys were getting. So I had to work more days to come up with at the end of the year to make enough money to survive and keep the band alive and keep me alive and keep food on the table, man. I did what I have to do, and I'm still doing it. I'm so glad to be back. Hopefully that is coming back around, that we can get back to work again and make things better. At least we feel good about doing it, you know?
I got to ask you one more thing before I go, and it's a stupid question. Are you ready for it?
Yes, I'm ready for it. You said it's a stupid question, I'm ready for it.
I've read your entire book, and I still don't understand what "I ain't studying you" means.
You don't understand "I ain't studying you." Let me explain to you. My mother was cooking the tea cakes back in the day when I was a boy. I used to help her in the kitchen and eat tea cakes as they get done. So by the time dinner got ready, I was full of tea cake. Then when the other kids came in to sit down and eat, I would eat with them. And I would say, "Mom, give me another tea cake." She said, "Boy, I ain't giving you nothing else," because she knew I'd be eating them all the time. She said, "I'm not giving you not one more tea cake. I ain't studying you, boy. That means I'm not thinking about you. Get out the kitchen." You know, that's where "I ain't studying you" come from.
Blues great Bobby Rush, the new memoir is "I Ain't Studying You." Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
If you think I'm gonna leave my woman because what somebody said, you must be crazy, gone out of your doggone head. I ain't studying you. I tell you, I ain't studying you.
Capitalism touches every part of our lives.
Capitalism is a giant force that I don't understand.
I feel that it's a very safe system.
I'm constantly in fear of losing my job.
It is our biggest success and our biggest failure.
On this special series from Throughline, Capitalism.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
A Nashville hairstylist is pushing the salon industry to address racism that disregards Black culture and clients. We're re-airing this report from Nashville Public Radio's Ambriel Crutchfield.
When Amber Curry started learning at Nashville's Aveda Institute, she saw Black folks weren't being welcomed like white clients.
No one was really being a hairstylist, you know, taking their craft seriously and being prepared for every person to sit in their chair.
Well, now as a former Aveda Institute teacher, Curry wants to address that discomfort with her program, Black Beauty School.
So we turn the blow dry on. High heat. High fan, and I'm going to run the blow dryer down the hair.
It's a six-hour class in which 25 attendees learn practical skills to make their salons more inclusive. Stylists who have little experience doing Black hair get hands-on about what products and techniques are needed to do natural hairstyles like a twist-out, Bantu knots, or a wash-and-go. Employers and school administrators have used hair to discriminate. That has triggered civil rights lawsuits and push some cities like Cincinnati and states like California to create legislation protecting Black women's crowns. The military has had its problems, too.
Specifically how many cornrows they can have, how big they are, the parties, how big the bun can be.
But things are changing on this. In May, the U.S. Army further relaxed some of their grooming standards to prevent hair loss and to allow people to express their cultural and gender identity. For centuries, Black women have embraced the versatility of their hair. Cicely Tyson, Lil' Kim, Michelle Obama, and Chloe and Halle have created new standards for self-expression. That impacts Black women and international beauty culture. Throughout the United States, beauticians have called out beauty schools for not fully preparing students to service Black clients.
And I like to let them hear that squeak, like, hey, that's what you should hear when you clarify, because that means, yeah.
So that leaves white stylists like Brooke Julian struggling over the basics, like washing hair.
And I know that this seems like a dumb little thing, but like, I had no idea that you were like supposed to get the hair clean enough to squeak.
Julian and other stylists also got to hear Black hair models share the ways race and privilege have unraveled in the salon chair. Jasmine Ellis talked about her traumatizing experience getting a green hair dye and pixie cut.
By the time I left the salon, my hair was at least green, but it was split, crunchy, not that soft, light kind of feeling that you get when you go to a salon.
Ellis was stunned that no stylist consulted her or offered alternatives that would have protected her hair. In America, beauty isn't just a fun way to switch up your look. It's been about power, too. Tiffany Gill is a history professor at Rutgers University. She says one of the ways white Europeans justified enslaving African people was because of their physical features.
Even today, when we think about standards of beauty, it much has to do with hierarchies of power and access.
Black people have always leaned into that power, whether it's supporting businesses like Madam C.J. Walker's. She's the first Black woman millionaire who made a fortune off catering her homemade line of hair care products to Black women. Or today, when Black people continue to embrace beauty standards that include their natural hair. Stylist Amber Curry says the Black Beauty School isn't about white guilt.
I want for Black folks to go out and to walk into any salon and to know that they are going to be treated equally.
She wants stylists to have the skills to pamper Black clients. For NPR, I'm Ambrielle Crutchfield in Nashville.
The number of people dead around the world from COVID-19 has surpassed 4 million. This week, the UN Director General described how variants are causing a wave of death in parts of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. In the U.S., it feels very different. Nearly half of Americans are fully vaccinated, and most restrictions are gone. But some areas of the country are struggling to get people vaccinated, and the Delta variant is spreading fast. Dr. Jean Marazzo is director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Alabama, by the way, has the lowest state vaccination rate in the country. Dr. Marazzo, welcome back.
Thanks, Peter. Good to be here.
So Georgetown University has identified clusters of infections in areas where vaccination rates are low. One is near you in Montgomery, Alabama. What are you seeing there in your home state?
Well, you're correct. Our vaccination coverage is really suboptimal. We have really not persuaded enough people to get out there and to get both doses of the vaccines that are available or the single J&J vaccine. We are starting, unfortunately, to see the ramifications of that. We are not at a point yet that some places are, like Nevada and Missouri, for example, which are clearly seeing an influx of predominantly younger unvaccinated patients in their intensive care units and in their hospitals, although we are seeing an uptick that I fear portends exactly what those states are seeing now. So we're really very concerned.
Well, this is why President Biden was saying earlier this week that more needs to be done to get shots into arms. Let's listen.
Now we need to go to community by community, neighborhood by neighborhood, and oftentimes door to door, literally knocking on doors, to get help to the remaining people protected from the virus.
Will that work in a place like Alabama if people don't want the shot?
Right. That's a complicated question, right? What does wanting the shot mean? Not wanting the shot probably comprises several different components that you've got to address. The first one that President Biden just mentioned is really eliminating any physical barriers or structural barriers to getting the vaccine. And if that means knocking on people's doors, coming to their churches, coming to their barbecues, all of that stuff really does need to happen. The problem is that the second big dimension of that reluctance is around trust. And so what we're hearing from many, many people here is that we just don't know yet if these vaccines are safe. I don't know that I want my kid to have it. I don't know that I want my whoever to have it. And so we really need to work on getting role models out there, peers out there, and also trusted healthcare providers to advocate to their patients to get this done. Healthcare providers have a huge role in making this happen.
But from what I can tell, people have been trying to do that, just that, exactly that, for the last several months. So is it working?
You know, I think they have, but honestly, I think this is underappreciated. You know, the public health and healthcare workforce in general is pretty exhausted from this pandemic. You know, it's one thing to really get out there and set up great new initiatives where you're energized and starting things. It's another, you know, to kind of be limping along after you've dealt with this pretty grievous blow of, as you mentioned, 4 million deaths worldwide. Alabama suffered pretty bad. I mean, I feel like people are just starting to get back on their feet. And so, you know, we've had to kind of do that at the same time that we're facing this onslaught of a potential new wave of infections due to these new variants. So I have sympathy for people, you know, trying to do it, but it's not as easy, particularly in states with an infrastructure that is as tenuous as ours to do.
Can we talk about the Delta variant for just a moment? It is now officially the country's most dominant strain, so contagious that one epidemiologist said that you could catch it just by walking by someone who is infected. Are descriptions like that hyperbole? Should we be that concerned?
I wish they were hyperbole. I try to greatly limit my tendency to hyperbole, but in this case, I'm afraid when you look at the trajectory of the numbers of infections, number one, absolute numbers, and then the proportion due to Delta, you got to respect this variant greatly. There are estimates that you can be infected just by being exposed to someone in the course of 5 to 10 seconds. Certainly from a molecular standpoint, the way that this variant has evolved its attachment spike protein makes it very, very sticky for your respiratory tract, your nasal tract. So it is not just hyperbole. I think it's theoretically and very realistically possible and backed up by the trends we're seeing.
Dr. Jean Marazzo is professor of medicine and director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Thank you very much, as always, for your time. I do appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter. Stay safe.
In Texas, lawmakers are back at the state capitol in Austin today for a special session. Governor Greg Abbott has reconvened the legislature after Texas House Democrats walked out to defeat a restrictive voting rights bill in May. Abbott is asking lawmakers to reconsider that measure less than a week after the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a similar law in Arizona. Also on the agenda for the special session are bills about transgender athletes and teaching critical race theory in schools. Let's bring in Ashley Lopez, reporter for KUT in Austin. Hey, Ashley.
Hey there.
So Governor Abbott says more needs to be done to protect the security of elections in Texas, although he's not offering evidence of fraud in recent elections. The restrictions proposed by Republicans in the regular legislative session included limits on Sunday voting, and critics say that was aimed at Souls to the Polls campaigns that are popular in black churches. New criminal penalties were also on the table. So what might be in a GOP bill in this special session?
Well, you know, originally, the last time lawmakers took up a voting bill, they had set their sights on creating restrictions around basically some of the things local election officials, mainly in Houston, did during the pandemic to make voting easier and safer. So restrictions around 24-hour voting centers, not allowing election officials to give vote-by-mail applications to people who hadn't asked for one, as well as bans on what, you know, was used as drive-through voting in Houston. But during the last session, there was a lot of other stuff that got added to the voting bill that I assumed could come back, and that includes things like you mentioned criminal penalties or steeper existing penalties for mistakes people make while voting, and allowing poll watchers more access to vote count centers and other parts of the voting process. And another provision that advocates are looking closely for are, or a set of provisions really, is they're looking out for things that, restrictions that make vote by mail and in-person voting harder for disabilities, people with disabilities, because those things got roped in sort of last minute into the process and have raised a lot of concerns. So, well, those are sort of the things I'm looking out for.
And it's an issue that really brings out strong feelings. I mean, we had a really intense showdown just a few weeks ago when Democrats staged that walkout. So I got to wonder if it's likely Republicans, Democrats can work together this time around.
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, right? Like, Democrats feel like they were left out of the first process. And, you know, a lot of the last-minute changes, like the Sunday voting that you mentioned, that was added to the bill in a secretive conference committee with very little input from Democrats, I think barely any, and, you know, even public input for that matter. So Democrats will say they will do what they can to obstruct any bill that is similarly pushed through in a secretive process, but they're willing to work with Republicans if they're actually brought in a meaningful way. But, you know, because of how special sessions work, I will say it will be harder for Democrats to really stop anything, you know, as effectively they did the last time.
And, you know, perhaps adding to the ill will was the retaliation after that walkout. Governor Abbott vetoed funding for the state legislature and thousands of legislative staffers. So that may influence the negotiations. I'm wondering, too, though, Ashley, about the potential influence of this recent Supreme Court decision in Arizona. Voting rights advocates are worried that that could hurt their standing in Texas. So refresh us on that case and what it could mean for Texas's special session now.
Well, the court basically set a higher bar for what, you know, for what voting advocates say is an infringement of voting, you know, voting rights under the Voting Rights Act. So advocates here worry that means there's just going to be fewer recourses in the courts if lawmakers in Texas end up passing something that does discriminate against voters of color, as was alleged in Arizona. And, you know, it's been actually a trend for a few years now that the federal courts have gotten more conservative and have ended up siding more often with Republican states that want to make voting a little harder. But I think, you know, this is a sign that in Texas there could be less hope that the Voting Rights Act specifically could provide protections for some voters, mainly voters of color.
All right. That's KUT reporter Ashley Lopez with the latest on the special session in Austin today. Ashley, thank you.
Thank you.
The western part of the United States has already endured a major heat wave, and another is about to descend on California. In British Columbia, Canada, which is on the border with Washington State, Idaho, and Montana, recent record temperatures have killed hundreds of people, caused hundreds of devastating wildfires. And for more on that, we're joined by CBC News senior reporter Lindsay Duncombe. Lindsay, the heat has been so dangerous that, as I said, hundreds of people died. Is there any precedent for this?
No, it certainly is unprecedented. And I think much of the province and much of the country is absolutely rattled. You know, here where I am in Vancouver, those deaths came, sudden deaths, as a result of the heat wave. And over a period of about a week, 719 people died. Now, we don't know exactly why they died, but we do know that that is three times more, triple the usual number of sudden deaths recorded in the province. That is the number for the entire province. And this is just shocking for the coroner. The ambulance services in many areas were just overwhelmed. A lot of these people were seniors. The province and the country really trying to come to grips with the fact that the services that are that exist to take care of people may not be enough.
So there's that, there's the human element, but there's also, we understand, at one point, 200 wildfires burning in British Columbia at one point this week. Describe the fire situation now and how that compares to previous seasons.
Well, there are still 200 wildfires burning as we speak. And again, this is earlier and more intense than previous fire seasons. The 10-year average would have seen a total of around 400 fires up until this point in the season. However, right now we've seen more than 700 fires, and those 200 that are burning right now are active fires. Of that, about a dozen of them are particularly concerning for the fire service here in British Columbia. Reinforcements have had to come in. There are dozens of firefighters coming in from other provinces in the east. The Canadian military has set up a base in Edmonton for at least the next couple of weeks where helicopters can go in and move crews to where they need to be if new fire starts happen, which is expected with lightning in the forecast. The area that we're talking about that is especially volatile right now is in the interior of the province near the border with Alberta. And that area often gets rain in the spring. So, yeah, there are fire starts, but they don't go very far. But because it's been so hot, the forest is just tinder dry. And that means the crews can't get there fast enough. The early ways that they would normally start a fire from going anywhere just don't cut it. And these fires then spread and become really huge and dangerous.
Well, and they do a lot of damage. The town of Lytton in southern BC, almost just completely destroyed by a wildfire during this heat wave or soon after it. What happened there?
Well, it happens so quickly, and there's a lot of discussion over exactly how the fire started. Investigators say they believe it was human-caused, not a lightning strike, but it took, you know, within an hour, and people had to leave, and the whole town was totally destroyed by flames. And two people were tragically killed. A couple, their son, they couldn't get out, so he had covered them up with a sheet of tin or some substance like that and hoped that the fire wouldn't get them. And they ended up that a power pole fell over and they tragically died, is a story that he recounted. Those people who live in the village of Lytton are expected to get back there this week on a bus tour scheduled for Friday. And by all accounts, what they'll see is absolutely devastating.
One of the residents who escaped from the fire was Gordon Murray, talking to the CBC here about the loss of the town.
It's a small, rural, indigenous, low-income community, and we're at the point, the spear point of climate change, but it's coming for everybody. We're the canary in the coal mine. We had the heat and the chaos, but we weren't prepared.
So talking about climate change there, and as he does, I'm seeing this report out this week from the University of British Columbia that says up to 1 billion clams, mussels, snails, sea life in these shallow waters off the west coast of the province died because of this heat wave. Is there a sense there in Western Canada that these shocking conditions could be a new normal?
I think that's really the concern, you know, both from people who live in these areas as well as the public officials. This really has been a chance for people to say, hey, if people in Vancouver called an ambulance or people in Burnaby called an ambulance and it didn't show up, and the people of Lytton only had minutes to get out of town, this is something that we need to prepare for in a different way.
The CBC's Lindsay Duncombe reporting from British Columbia. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. This is Here and Now.